Jack McLennan was 27, fit and visibly strong.
He was trained well. He knew how to hit and I was gobsmacked.
He seemed ready for anything, but then he suddenly vanished.
I was just talking to him last night. Like, how the hell does that happen?
I'm Rob Bergen. Join me as I investigate what became of Jack in the new season of Unravel.
There has to be something more nefarious going on.
Search for the Unravel podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
From Wondery Country, I'm Luke Siddham-Dundon, and today on The Breakfast Wrap, it has been 6 months since the start of Australia's under-16s social media ban. In a moment, you're going to hear from the mother who addressed the UN General Assembly, convincing foreign leaders to follow in Australia's footsteps. So how does she think Australia's world-leading policy is going?
Did these reforms make our environment, our country, safer for children? And is there now a really clear national conversation about children online, rather than adults going, this is too hard, I can't beat this algorithm?
That is coming up. Then we'll head to the streets of Belfast, where there's been a violent night of anti-immigration protests after the attempted alleged murder of a man in a brazen knife attack. Homes are on fire, police are calling for calm. So what are the forces driving these protests? That insight is coming up. From the Radio National Breakfast Team, this is The Breakfast Wrap. Remember the teen social media ban? Last year was a really big discussion in Australia, and the federal government made sure that the rest of the world was talking about it too. It brought along an Australian to the UN General Assembly to share her experience on stage. You might remember that person. Her name was Emma Mason. She's a lawyer from Bathurst in New South Wales, and she went to New York with a really serious story. The story of her own child who took her life due to online bullying. When Emma fronted that stage at the UN General Assembly last year, she drew praise from the European Commission President, Ursula von der Leyen.
Thank you so much for your words. It's not easy to speak after you. Prime Minister, Anthony, I want to thank you and Emma for bringing us here together. This is a bold decision that you have taken, and it's an example of what determined countries can do. Since the announcement of Australia's landmark minimum age law, I've been watching very closely, and I've been inspired by Australia's example.
EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen there. So why are we talking about this now? Well, today marks 6 months since Australia's social media ban for under-16s actually took effect. Millions of underage accounts have been deleted under the new restrictions, but still, many teens continue to access restricted content, increasing scrutiny on platforms like Facebook and TikTok. And then overseas, Denmark, Germany, Malaysia have all announced similar reforms. And in just days, the UK is expected to confirm its plans. This morning, Emma Mason joined Sally Sarah on Radio National Breakfast for her scorecard on how Australia's reforms have gone.
We're 6 months down the track since the start of these restrictions here in Australia. Have the reforms achieved what you'd been hoping for so far, or is it too early to tell?
Well, I think it's a complicated question with a complicated answer. So what we wanted is ultimately to get children offline from particular platforms. And so certainly that's a work in progress. As you would expect, it was never going to be successful day one or day seven. So it is absolutely, we're on the track. But at the same time, the question is really not about whether or not every child under 16 is offline. The question is, did these reforms make our environment, our country, safer for children? And is there now a really clear national conversation about children online, rather than adults, parents, just like me going, this is too hard, I can't beat this algorithm. So there is success in this.
An e-safety report released back in March revealed that 7 out of 10 children under 16 were still accessing social media. Emma, what further steps do you think need to be taken to get kids offline and keep them offline?
Well, I think as with anything, and this was always a big voice around this, is education. We need to get digital literacy in our schools. And we are talking about a social harm. It's a social heroine. So we need to do the best we can do to support children and to support parents and to support teachers. But it's also a good news story in one sense. We know that some of the research has shown that children's mental health has improved, according to children, by 60%, and parents say by 62%. So we certainly are seeing changes, conversations, and that's really important in my view.
The eSafety report also found there'd been, in its findings, no notable change in cyberbullying or image-based abuse reported by children since the ban came in. How do you reflect on those findings?
That's a really sad finding, because it's really not only just the method by which those social harms are happening, but the origin, of course, is the children. Children are still engaging in this behaviour, and that's why education is so incredibly important.
What more needs to happen in Australia, in your view, Emma?
Oh, I think we need a whole lot more work on supporting the Safety Commissioner and making sure that big tech is held accountable. I understand there are 10 current investigations on the eSafety Commissioner about systemic breaches by the big tech companies. But unfortunately, it's just not a quick process. It's not like sending a ticket, like a police officer. You sped like that, there's your account, here's your $47 million. There is a process. It has to go through due process. It's not fast enough for me, but it also needs to be appropriate. And I say that as a lawyer, because it will then fall apart if it's not properly done. If there isn't appropriate evidence, of course. And remember, I want always the listeners to think about this. We weren't stopping children. The idea of this is not stopping children accessing social media. It's stopping big tech from accessing our children. And we know these are real social harms that need to be addressed, because children's mental health is so important, and suicide is on the rise in children.
Emma, sometimes when parents step up and step forward to advocate for a child who has died, there can be great meaning for them in that fight. Has there been a price for you as well in speaking up and standing up?
Yeah, there absolutely has been a price. And it's a price that, you know, I have to talk about till in a public space. And then I talk about how she was subject to online bullying. And then I have people online bully me and tell me that I'm a terrible parent, that it's my fault that my daughter died, that they swear at me. It's really horrific. But at the same time, I just have to hold fast to what I know to be true, that if people don't stand up for what's right, if they don't stand up for what needs to happen for change, then we're just acquiescing. And it doesn't put my darling Tilly back. It doesn't bring her back at all. But it at least reminds me daily of the real harm that can occur. And I'm fairly proud of my little girl.
And that is Emma Mason, an independent children's lawyer and one of the leading advocates for Australia's social media ban. And if any parts of that conversation raised issues for you or someone you know, you can call Lifeline on 131114. That's 13 11 14. There's also Beyond Blue on 1300 224 636, and the Kids Helpline is on 1800 551 800. Now, listening into that interview with Emma was Green Senator for South Australia, Sarah Hanson-Young. She is the party spokesperson for communications and the environment. And here's what she told Sally about what Emma had to say and Australia's progress.
Listening to Emma then, and she really does articulate the anguish that Australian parents, and in fact parents right across the world, have in dealing with their children and young people as engagement online, whether that's on social media, on gaming platforms, which of course are largely unregulated in this space, and increasingly now the dangers of AI and AI bots. And I think all the best intentions were there when this proposition was put forward. Emma's right. We do need to hold these big tech companies accountable for the products that they make massive profits off, the products that they push into the hands of our young people. But sadly, the way this blunt ban has been put in place means that there's a lot of young people, in fact, the vast majority of young people, who are still caught up in the system. The safety net has got a lot of holes in it. In fact, it's little more of a safety net and more of a it's trying to fence the ocean, as the e-safety commissioner herself, Grant, has said. What we really need to be doing is getting these social media companies to have a legal obligation to provide a duty of care to all their users, whether they are children, whether they are young people, teenagers or adults. We've got to hit them where it hurts, and that's their business model. They thrive and they make massive profits off these dangerous algorithms. And unless we regulate those algorithms, unless we make sure that those algorithms are transparent and safe, we're going to continue to see people young and old fall through the cracks in this really dangerous online space. It's why we need things like the Fix Our Feeds campaign, which is a campaign that's being pushed by people like Chanel Contos and the Teach Us Consent outfit. That whole idea is to say users need to be in control of what's in our feeds, not the big tech companies, not their business models making massive profits. You know, these platforms are designed by nature to be addictive. That's now been found out in the US courts of law. These platforms, these big social media companies, have created products that are deliberately addictive. Doom scrolling is product by design, and that's what we need to tackle.
And Senate inquiry into the potential impacts of artificial intelligence and data centres. Are you concerned that Australian regulations aren't strong enough in this space?
Look, I'm very concerned about this, and so are so many other Australians. You know, AI is the new extractive industry, and it needs regulation, and we need to make sure the community is actually getting a dividend from it. Just like we've failed to regulate social media and to try and retrofit laws later on, we're sleepwalking into this AI catastrophe if we don't regulate now, and if we don't put some guardrails and handbrakes in the system. It's an extractive industry, because not only is it extracting our intelligence, our knowledge, our culture, these big AI data centres, which are basically data mining centres, are going to be extracting huge amounts of water and energy as well. There's a huge push on for data centres to be built right across the country, very little community consultation, very little give back to the community, very little social licence, and all for what? To make massive profits for these new big tech companies that are putting huge amount of pressure on governments right around the world. There's a reason why these big tech companies are honing in on Australia right now. And it's because they see the Australian regulation system and the Australian government and political will as weak and lambs at the slaughter. And we've got to stand up to them.
Green Senator for South Australia, Sarah Hanson-Young there. She is the party spokesperson for communications and also the environment. Well, while we're talking about artificial intelligence, the warnings aren't just coming from politicians, but also the sector itself. This month, one of the world's biggest and most valuable artificial intelligence companies, Anthropic, made an extraordinary call. It appealed to rivals to pause work on the technology. The company warned in a blog post that humanity is fast approaching a point where it could lose control of the technology that it's racing to build. In Australia, the federal government has signed a memorandum of understanding with Anthropic, prompting questions about just how well prepared the country is for the rise of AI. Professor Jeannie Patterson was formerly on the government's AI advisory panel. She now co-directs the University of Melbourne's Centre for AI and Digital Ethics. And Sally got her to unpack just what was said by Anthropic.
This is quite an extraordinary statement. So this is Anthropic effectively calling for a treaty, a ceasefire on developing AI. What do you make of that?
Well, it's surprising, but not altogether. Remember that OpenAI is about to go public. It's about to have a fundraising through issuing shares in its company. And that sort of commercial pressure is going to change the way that the these AI providers operate quite significantly. And it's thought that OpenAI will come under pressure from shareholders, and that might change the way they do business. For Anthropic, that holds itself out as the sort of ethical provider, it has both developed Mythos, which is very powerful, but also it itself will fill at some point the pressure for fundraising. So in a way, it's both a commercial decision, I suspect, as well as an existential one.
Are there any countries around the world that are effectively legislating when it comes to the ethics of AI, or is everyone kind of scratching their heads still at the moment?
Well, the EU has its EU AI Act, and there was discussion in 2024 about whether Australia should follow that model. The problem with an act directed at AI is, as Mythos demonstrate, the AI is probably changing faster than a single piece of legislation can keep up with. And in fact, the trend we're seeing around the world is to strengthen sectoral regulators, so regulators that work in particular industries, but also to provide funding for AI safety, or in the case of the UK, security institutes, which are able to provide the technical expertise to respond to things like Mythos, and indeed also the rise of chatbots engaging in sort of harmful behaviours such as the phenomenon of AI psychosis.
Mm. How do we keep a handle on all this when the uses of AI are so broad? Someone could be using it to cheat on an exam or a presentation. Someone could be using it for emotional support. Someone else could be using it to go through large amounts of data to come up with an answer or a development which could aid humanity. How do you deal with all of those different kinds of scenarios?
Well, this is the argument, in fact, for a sectoral approach or a networked approach, as I like to call it, regulatory networks, where you have regulators with expertise in each of those different domains. So medical research, we have the TGA, interactions for personal support, we actually have the Safety Commissioner, we have the ACCC and so on. All of these regulators have expertise in their domain. And the idea of the AI Safety Institute is indeed to provide them with the technical clout, if you like, to be able to interrogate the AI that's being used in particular areas and also to regulate it before it's too late.
Professor Jeannie Patterson there. She was formerly on the government's AI advisory panel. She's now at the University of Melbourne's Centre for AI and Digital Ethics as the co-director. So throughout the morning, we were watching incredible scenes, video feeds shot from helicopters of chaos in the city of Belfast. Against the setting sun, smoke was shrouding parts of the city from fires burning in various neighbourhoods. Bins, one bus, and as the morning progressed, even a few houses ablaze with emergency services rushing all over the place. This was the result of significant, violent anti-immigration protests in the city. They followed shocking footage of an alleged attempted murder, a knife attack that police have described as brutal. Police have since arrested and charged a Sudanese national. The Northern Irish First Minister, Michelle O'Neill, has condemned the alleged attack, but also says that there are now masked men burning families out of their homes. She's called it disgusting cowardice and labelled it outright thuggery.
Violence like this has no place in our community. Don't allow those people that don't care about people here to incite hatred, to incite fear. We have no tolerance for sectarianism, for hatred, for division. And to all those people out there that are stoking up tensions, particularly in that social media space, who have no care or interest in the people here but are happy to, you know, raise tensions, I say they do not represent us.
And some of the figures you might be talking about there, anti-immigration and anti-Muslim activist Tommy Robinson, who posted mass march details for locations all around Britain, which were then shared online by the world's richest man, tech giant Elon Musk. So some really powerful supporters of the messages that are being shared by this protest movement. So first thing this morning, we crossed to Belfast with Belfast Telegraph reporter Curtis Reid to find out just what was driving these protests.
Last night, we woke up to some very distressing footage this morning here in Northern Ireland, which showed a man who's now been identified as a Sudanese national, who's around 30 years old, on top of another man, and he was essentially stabbing him in the neck. It was quite brutal footage, sort of sent shockwaves across Northern Ireland. Now, the man was taken away from the scene and was arrested, and he's now since been charged with attempted murder. And the victim himself was later taken to hospital with significant, very serious critical injuries, and he's currently still in that condition in hospital.
Curtis, how does this fit into the bigger picture of political tensions and racial tensions that we've seen flaring up, particularly in England?
Yeah, I mean, obviously we had the Henry Novak incident a couple of weeks ago in England, and then exactly a year ago this week, Northern Ireland had its own tensions over immigration in the streets of Ballymena, a small village just in North Antrim. So yeah, so I mean, this comes at a time where, you know, tensions around immigration status and immigration levels, particularly in Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK, is obviously incredibly high. So this is just obviously very, you know, inflamed the situation.
What sort of messages and questions are being raised about immigration levels in Northern Ireland right now?
Well, I think in particular when it comes to this case, you know, the First and the Deputy First Minister, Michelle O'Neill and Emma Little-Pengelly, were questioned today in regards to the actual immigration status of the perpetrator of this brutal attack. You know, they asked, you know, how he was able to get into Northern Ireland and what route that he actually did take. It was later confirmed that he arrived via Dublin, where he claimed asylum and then was given leave to remain status in Northern Ireland up until about February 2028. So, I mean, there are questions around the status, you know, of you know, illegal immigration here. Now, I will point out, and it is worth mentioning, that when it comes to the statistics around immigration, Northern Ireland does still remain, you know, one of the lowest places in the UK in regards to migration levels. But it's obviously something that is incredibly, you know, there's a lot of tension around the levels here, particularly with the influx of people who've came via the south of Ireland and the Republic of Ireland up to the north.
Curtis, Northern Ireland certainly has its own political ecosystem with some of the issues from the past and issues of the present together. What sort of presence do groups like Reform have in Northern Ireland right now?
I wouldn't say a large presence. I mean, we're definitely seeing sort of breadcrumbs being laid by, you know, the likes of Reform, you know, particularly here. You know, I don't think it's not as, certainly not as widespread as it is in England. They don't have an official party here in Northern Ireland yet or anything like that. I mean, there's lots of mixed messaging when it comes to the topic of immigration, when it comes to Northern Ireland's own political parties. Sinn Féin, who, you know, obviously our First Minister, Michelle O'Neill, is the vice president of that party. There's a lot of critique around Sinn Féin's messaging of immigration because it seems to differ in the south compared to the north. So when it comes to the influence of parties like Reform, it's not substantial, but with incidents like this, there is obviously fears between lots of communities that type of messaging will catch on.
In Northern Ireland, that is the Belfast Telegraph reporter, Curtis Reid, speaking to Sally Sarah on Radio National Breakfast. Well, thank you for listening to all of those interviews. They were produced by the Radio National Breakfast team, and Oscar Coleman produced today's episode of The Breakfast Wrap. As always, you can always catch The Breakfast Wrap on Radio National at 11:30, whenever you like, on ABC Listen. And if you are listening to us on other platforms, a reminder again that you can chuck us a follow, leave us a review, let us know what you're thinking about the program. We'd love to hear from you. I'm Luke Zidane-Dundon. We'll see you tomorrow.